current state on 90.5 WKAR. We mentioned the novel about the murder mystery. The murder mystery novel set on the MSU campus. We'll be hearing. We'll be visiting with the author here later this hour. But we also have a book review from our book reviewer Scott Southard, Christopher Moore's Serpent of Venice. So there's a fairly literary vibe the show here today, more so than usual. It's current state on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. July 2014 will be history in a matter of hours. Let's take a few minutes to review what happened in July here in Michigan. There was plenty. Joining me to review the month, the Michigan Public Radio Network Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Mark.
Jonathan Osting covers the state capitol for MLive. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thank you.
And welcome back, Susan Demas of Inside Michigan Politics.
Hi.
Much of July was spent anticipating next Tuesday, I think. The midterm primary is 5 days away, and there's a number of races and topics that we could talk about. We won't have time for all of them, but let's start with what appears to be a confusing proposition. Proposal 1, which includes a framework to restore revenue to local governments that would be taken away by removing the personal property tax. It seems to be a head-scratcher for an awful lot of people. Jonathan, can you explain the measure here for us?
Sure. You mentioned that the thing people are actually going to vote on is replacement revenue for local governments who would lose money if the personal property tax on small business equipment and on large industrial manufacturing equipment is phased out, which the legislature has already approved. So voters are deciding the fate of the PPT ultimately, but what they're really going to see on the ballot is this question of shifting some use tax dollars that the state currently collects to a local version that would then be used to repay local governments. So it is confusing. There's a ton of support for it. State government leaders, local government leaders, business groups, of course, who would benefit from it are out front spending a lot of money promoting it. But there's still a very real possibility it's going to fail because of that confusion we just mentioned.
Well, you're wading into the tax code, and I think anytime that happens, it's a pretty heavy lift for an awful lot of people. 5 days before the vote, what are you hearing?
That we were talking about this before the show, and the little bit of public opinion research that we've seen on it shows that the prospects for Proposal 1 are not promising, and this is largely anecdotal, but there does seem to be sort of a rising tide of skepticism about it, largely, based on just how complex and confusing it is. And a lot of people just seem to be looking at it and trying to, figure out where is the raw deal in this, that, businesses are spending literally millions of dollars on advertising right now, trying to convince people that that this is a good deal. And everyone's just sort of wondering, if this is such a good deal, why can't this be easily explained?
And the conventional wisdom seems to be that when voters are confused, they are more likely to vote.
That's not the conventional wisdom. That's a reality.
Okay. It's more than conventional wisdom.
Sure. One of the spokespeople promoting this issue is actually recommending to voters, if you don't understand it, maybe just take a pass on this one, which is an interesting suggestion.
Inspire a lot of confidence in their position.
Well, part of it too, might be that the legislature maybe got just a little bit too cute by half. That that when they passed the law to do this, the bill to do this, that instead of leaving it to state elections officials to craft, the language that would appear on the ballot, is that they did it themselves as part of the law and slipped in, these propaganda points that this is for small businesses, for example, just to name one. Their goal was to try and sort of put a nice sheen on a very complicated tax question, but maybe it just looked to some people like they were trying a little bit too hard.
Well, if you read the language, you pretty much have to be a tax accountant to understand it, which is not a good strategy when you have a proposal for the general public. The words personal property tax don't appear anywhere in the ballot question themselves.
We have elections professionals who, you know, are practiced at boiling complex questions down to 150 words, but that wasn't good enough for the legislature.
I'm also struck by something that Jonathan alluded to a minute ago, and that is that there is a diverse group of interests that do support the proposal. I can't help but think that part of what's confusing voters here is, in a way, they've forgotten what to make of bipartisanism. If you can call that bipartisanism, it's a lot harder to form an opinion when there isn't the partisan divide that we've all grown accustomed
is,
to.
What there is not is organized opposition. You know, what we've been talking about is, you know, the unorganized, not disorganized, but unorganized skepticism. So you've got businesses, especially manufacturers, and of course that's a big deal in Lansing, who are for this because it's big money. They've been wanting to get rid of this personal property tax for decades. Mm-hmm. So they're and it's just been so complex. This is their moment. So they're for it. Local government officials are for it, despite the fact that you know they're somewhat skeptical of promises, you know, from Lansing, and that the legislature could go back and change this law if they wanted to, because this is the best deal that they could get, and they're really concerned about the alternative. If Proposal 1 goes down, the legislature is not going to give up on getting rid of the personal property tax, and what might happen then in a lame duck session of the legislature if this doesn't pass. And, you know, then you've got just a lot of other ancillary groups that are, you know, sort of tagged on because they have their own individual reasons. But almost all of them are on board, not because they love it, unlike the business groups, but because it's the least objectionable deal they could come up with.
Mm. We'll also point out that one of the higher profile opponents of Proposal 1, Warren Mayor Jim Fouts, mm-hmm. appears on Michigan Public TV's Off the Record. Just mm-hmm. in the event you're not confused enough already,
even local officials are not unanimous in that this is a good deal. And the skepticism is primarily in that this is not an ironclad guarantee that local governments will continue to get that revenue. This is a statutory a mechanism to allow this to happen. And I think the estimates, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, that this would mean the diversion of about $500 million yes. from the state's general fund in about 10 years.
Sure.
So if 10 years from now, the legislature is looking at some budget troubles and saying, you know what, we think that we have a better idea on how to use $500 million than to keep sending it to local governments, they could change the law.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. We will move on here to a proposal to bring young Central American asylum seekers to Vassar, Michigan in Genesee County. That proposal led to some sharp dialogue and protests earlier this month. These would be 60 to 120 young refugees that are among the tens of thousands who have appeared at our southern border in recent months. Rick Pluta, remind us what this is all about.
Well, Wolverine Human Services operates a facility for at-risk youth up in Vassar. It's in the Thumb, and they got a contract from the federal government to take in some of these. They're unaccompanied minors, mostly teenagers. That they would come in, like you said, 60 to 120 kids, and they would be there for roughly a month before they were put into the immigration system and dealt with. And you know what's happened is just sort of this explosion of protest up in Vassar. There's actually, it's become an issue in a Republican state Senate primary in the area that the Republican challenger, who's a state representative, Kevin Daley, has asked for high priority legislation to cut state funding to Wolverine for doing this. And his opponent has said, why are we going to cut you know, money for helping Michigan kids at this facility because you don't like what's happening with the Central American kids. But it's just become just, you know, one more, you know, sharp point in the debate over immigration and what we do about, you know, these people who are actually coming over the borders. I mean, that is a reality that these kids are coming, they're here, and, you know, something needs to be done while, you know, their final disposition is sorted out.
Vassar, as you said, Rick, is in the congressional district represented by Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee, who was on Current State to discuss this. One of his key points was that the Central American asylum seekers should not be confused with the broader issue of immigration reform. Let's listen to his comments. Here he's referring to immigration reform here.
It's an important question. It's one that I wish that the Republican leadership in Congress would allow a full and complete debate on so that we could get on with dealing with the immigration crisis. Our broken immigration system needs to be addressed. This situation is a case in point. But we can't allow, I don't think, a true humanitarian crisis to be conflated with the immigration question and then miss the opportunity and I think the obligation to protect children who are in danger.
Susan, any thoughts on those remarks? I mean, is he right to warn about conflating immigration reform on one hand with this situation?
Well, this is a unique situation. The reason why these children are coming over is the extreme violence in a lot of these Central American countries like Honduras. These children are coming from the murder capital of the world. And the reason why they've been able to stay here and go through the immigration system is because of some legislation that was passed during the George W. Bush administration that was meant to halt human trafficking and to help these children so they're not just sent back into these horrible conditions. And so while a lot of people don't want these children in Vassar, and there have been these very virulent protests, and people, you know, say just turn them away at the border, actually, with current law passed by Congress, that is not possible.
That's right. And the president, to be clear, the president has called for alterations to the Wilberforce Act in order to more efficiently deal with this situation. But that is the law right now. There were also several hostile encounters between opposing groups of protesters 2 weeks ago here in Lansing that were triggered by this. There was at least one arrest, a Lansing organization, Action of Greater Lansing, also called on the Lansing City Council to agree, in principle at least, on a framework to let some of these Central Americans come to Lansing. Do we know where that stands?
I don't, but you know, Lansing does have a refugee relocation center, and you know, it has been doing this for a very, very, very long time from, you know, hotspots all over the world.
It's our month in review segment here on WKAR's Current State. Our guests, Rick Pluta from the Michigan Public Radio Network, Jonathan Osting of MLive, and Susan Demas of Inside Michigan Politics. Let's spend a minute on the campaign for governor, which is ongoing. Several times in just the last few days, Democrat Mark Schauer released plans. One, he says, would revitalize Michigan's economy. Susan, what was in there?
Well, it's this time of year where we see politicians' 10-point plans. Mark Schauer has, you know, a not very surprising plan. It's pretty much the Democratic Party platform as far as increasing renewable energy, increasing funding for education. And his goal is
don't forget the pension tax.
Right. Let's get rid of repeal the senior tax, pension tax, tax on retirement income, whatever phrasing you would like to use. And basically, he's kind of housing the all of these economic points in one blueprint. And he's saying that this is what's really going to turn around Michigan's economy. A central theme of his campaign has been that Governor Rick Snyder has not done enough, that his measures like right to work and his individual tax increases have not really had the effect that they were supposed to. So he's saying, he's gotten a lot of criticism for, well, what's your plan? this is Mark Schauer's plan.
Sure.
Any response?
And it's not just Schauer's not just saying that Snyder hasn't done enough. He's also saying he's done the wrong thing. So he's talking about rolling back a lot of things that the governor has done beyond the pension tax, also restoring homestead property tax credits, earned income, and child credits on taxes. He's mentioned getting rid of the emergency manager law and replacing it with a modified transition scheme. I'm not exactly sure how it would work. But his plan
and repealing
essentially
right to work.
And repealing,
you know,
right
I
to
mean,
work,
it's,
of course.
Which sure. His ability to do that is pretty
limited.
Questionable, but nevertheless, that it's, you know.
Sure.
Something that you've got to bang the drum on.
And, of course, fix the roads, but he didn't offer a highly specific plan for doing so. He said he opposes gas tax increase, which the governor and the state legislature have debated and not done. So he doesn't want to do that. One of his ideas is to get more money from Washington, D.C.,
which is every politician's idea sure. is to get more money from Washington, D.C. I'm going to get more money from my mom. it's interesting on road funding, though, that he was very, except for opposing a fuel tax increase, he was very nonspecific on where it would come from, just basically said that because of his background as a legislator, he would have the skills to bring people together. But it was a little bit reminiscent of where Rick Snyder was at the beginning, way at the beginning of the gas tax debate. Remember that he came to the conclusion early on that putting a specific proposal on the table was probably a bad idea.
Well, when he did,
because the legislature will just pick it apart.
Right.
You know?
I mean, we saw in his State of the State for last year, he was very specific that he wanted to increase vehicle registration fees, by an average of at least $100 per car.
He was also very specific that it was just an idea to talk about,
But it becomes more than an amorphous idea when you actually put numbers to the plan, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I think he learned his lesson, and I think that Mark Schauer saw that. And, as much as we might, as journalists, may try and hold politicians accountable to be specific, it's usually not a bad thing to be vague.
If you're the politician.
Right.
How are the Schauer plans being received? Have they created any kind of response?
Environmentalists were really happy because he also resurrected the renewable energy mandates which voters just rejected on the ballot. But, the idea that if you increase the mandate on utilities to generate more electricity using renewable fuels, that there will be a commensurate boost to the Michigan economy because we will build here because we can build here wind turbines, solar panels. You know, we have the people, the infrastructure, the whatnot. So that is sort of this government-led prescription to boost the economy.
Sure. In that case, we actually have a reversal where the governor is generally probably going to support some sort of new mandate, but said this isn't the year to do it in an election season. Mm-hmm. So he has not offered a specific plan.
Well,
Mark Schauer is offering with a plan, which was recommended by Snyder administration commission. So.
His mantra has been flexibility.
Sure.
I just can't get over the flurry of plans. We had a 10-point jobs plan, a 5-point proposal to help women in the workplace, and charter school proposals. Mm. I want to say these were all released in under 5 days, 4 days, something like that. Is this a belated response to Republicans who have been saying Schauer doesn't have a plan?
Well, obviously, I think that the intention is to blunt that criticism. But I think it's also an attempt by Mark Schauer, who has not raised nearly as much money as the incumbent Rick Snyder, to get some earned media and to have us talk about him because he can't afford to be on the air with commercials right now.
A top Detroit development, the top Detroit development of July had to be the response to ongoing water service shutoffs to people who either couldn't or wouldn't pay their bills. Rick, what was this about?
Wow, how much time do we have? the Duggan administration, came in that the mayor has control of the water department now. And the water department decided after many years of being lax about it that it was time to go after people who weren't paying their water bills for whatever reasons. Apparently, the average delinquent water bill in Detroit is about $500. And they succeeded in getting more people to either pay their water bills or get on a payment plan. But they also wound up cutting off a lot of people, and that sparked a lot of angst, a lot of protests, a lot of debate about whether or not the capacity to get water in a city is
a human right.
Is a human right. As a matter of fact, in some places there were even campaigns for people to like adopt a water customer. You know, if you're outraged by what's going on in Detroit, then you know, pick up the tab for you know, for someone. And the you know, water department officials said that you know, they really miscalculated the ferocity of the pushback on it, that people would be so angry about having their water shut off, and maybe if they had it all to do over again, that it would have been over a longer period of time, that they would have done more outreach to try and get people onto payment plans and things like that, you know. And
others disagree. I mean, other people insisted that this was primarily about getting people who can pay to pay, and apparently it is a long-standing practice in a lot of cities. It's an incentive to get scofflaws to pay up.
Oh, sure, and you know, it's always a controversy. I mean, we go through this you know, every winter, and you know, I mean, Michigan has reined in utilities' ability to shut off people's heat for non-payment in winter because there's just a similar controversy about that. That, you know, for whatever reasons, you know, there are just times when, you know, turning off the heat is unacceptable. And people are saying that, you know, when you live in the city of, when you live in a large city.
A bankrupt city. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you know, simply taking away, you know, just simply cutting off low-income people's, you know, capacity to get water isn't the right thing to do.
Well, part of the controversy is that people have argued that this is more arbitrary, the, you know, who got shut off. Some of the bigger customers did not have their water shut off. Which
businesses
specifically. And so there seemed to be one set of rules for individuals, one set of rules for businesses. This also coincided at a time of a liberal blogging convention in Detroit, Netroots Nation. And so this rose to prominence as more of a national issue. There was a big rally, and that kind of brought the issue to a fever pitch and resulted in this 15-day suspension.
Let's return briefly. We've got just a couple of minutes here. Let's return to next Tuesday. Which primary races are you watching most closely?
Well, I cover the state legislature primarily. I'm looking at a couple state house races that I think are really interesting. Some Tea Party candidates, Gary Glenn, Todd Corser, are each running in Midland and Lapeer, respectively. And they're up against what some might call the establishment. The DeVos family of West Michigan is spending a lot of money, and an education group they're associated with is running some really negative mailers against both of those Tea Party candidates, supporting more traditional Republicans for the race.
Talk to us about the 8th district, where we sit right now. Is this Mike Bishop's primary to lose and Eric Schertzing's primary to lose? What do you make of what's going on in the 8th?
Well, on Schertzing, basically he got thrown into the race late in the game because Democrats wanted to be prepared if an opportunity presented itself. They think that that opportunity would come in the form of the nomination of Tom McMillan, who's, you know, much more of a Justin Amash type of Republican. You know, Mike Bishop has racked up the party endorsements. The incumbent Mike Rogers has endorsed him, you know, plus a lot of others. You know, as a factual matter, there really isn't a whole lot of daylight between, you know, Bishop and McMillan when it comes to policy. So, you know, really this is just about, you know, how they're going about characterizing each other and probably who would, you know, make a better legislator rather than, you know, where they stand philosophically. I will say one race I am it's not in this area, but up in Northwest Michigan is Frank Foster's re-election bid. That he's behind. He's the Republican who's been talked about as the possible sponsor to an amendment to add LGBT to the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. And a lot of the future of that, the balance of this session, depends on whether or not Foster survives his primary.
We have to leave it there. We want to thank our guests for our Month in Review segment, Rick Plute of the Michigan Public Radio Network, Jonathan Osting, thank you, from MLive, Susan Demos, thank you, from Inside Michigan Politics, and we're all waiting for Tuesday. Thanks very much. Reminder to our mid-Michigan listeners that if you are attending the Great Lakes Folk Festival here next weekend, not this coming weekend, but the following weekend, Current State will be broadcasting live from the Great Lakes Folk Festival in downtown East Lansing Friday evening, a week from tomorrow evening, 6 to 7 p.m. We'll be looking for you. As enrollment in the state's Healthy Michigan program continues, many of the state's community mental health or CMH officials have been sounding the alarm that they do not have sufficient funds to treat everyone who comes to them for help. In fact, there have already been scattered reports of people being cut off from state mental health services due to the shift in funding caused by the Medicaid expansion. On Monday, the Mental Health Association in Michigan held a special meeting to address the potential crisis. Here to tell us more is Mark Reinstein, the president and CEO of the Mental Health Association in Michigan. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
You held this meeting on Monday to address funding concerns that apparently many CMHs have. One of the main issues seems to be whether there will be sufficient funding for services for people who do not qualify for Medicaid, even under the Medicaid expansion in Healthy Michigan. Is that correct?
Yes. If you go back, say, 20 years ago, and you looked at an annual legislative appropriation for community mental health care and treatment, it was one line. It was everything. Starting in the late 90s, because Michigan, like all other states, has tried to find more and more ways to get Medicaid to pick up more and more health care costs. Starting around 1999, our legislature split that community mental health care and treatment line into a Medicaid line and a non-Medicaid line. And now, with Michigan being a state that's elected to expand Medicaid, which is great. I mean, everyone in the healthcare field is behind that, and we encourage everyone who's eligible to get signed up. The question then became, how many of the non-Medicaid individuals that community mental health was treating would, under the Medicaid expansion, be eligible for it?
Mm-hmm.
And there has been a debate, disagreement between state government on one hand and the state's community mental health programs, on the other hand, about what would be the right breakdown for reapportioning that money based on expected movement of some people from previous non-Medicaid status to now being enrolled in the new expansion program. So we tried to bring together both parties. Graciously, both parties participated. We brought in a number of people from the human service community so we could all learn more about this, some legislative staff to try to begin a dialogue on where are we, what are the potential problems and issues, and with a new fiscal year starting October 1, what is the right amount of money to have in the FY fiscal year 15 budget for community mental health non-Medicaid services?
You refer to potential problems. From what you're hearing now, have CMHs in the state already had to deny services to people they once served?
It would appear that some of them have. I don't have access to all the information that the Department of Community Health does or that the CMHs do, but I've been able to gather in the last couple of months some different types of materials that clearly indicate that at least six of the state's 46 CMH programs have already reduced or announced reductions in some types of services for people who are not enrolled in any type of Medicaid. Now, if it's only six out of 46, then maybe the problem at the moment isn't highly widespread. But the fact that the materials I've gathered only relate to six doesn't mean there aren't more. We just don't know at the moment, and that's one of the things we need information on. How widespread is it that people are getting cut off right now under this year's reduced general fund non-Medicaid appropriation? When you look at the numbers for what the CMH has asked for the current fiscal year and what was ultimately appropriated, it shouldn't be widespread yet. But we don't know if it is or isn't. Next year, when the legislature's appropriation, October 1 for non-Medicaid, would kick in, they put it at $97 million. 2 years ago, it was close to $300 million. That is a substantial cut. And what the two sides can't seem to agree on, and we don't know all their methodologies yet that each side used, is how many people will still be left in the non-Medicaid pool.
Mark Reinstein is our guest. He is the president and CEO of the Mental Health Association of Michigan, and we're talking about concerns he and others have with regard to service cutoffs for non-Medicaid recipients of mental health assistance here in Michigan. When we talk about the non-Medicaid population, who are we talking about? Who are typically the people who don't qualify for Medicaid-funded services?
Well, if you look at the fact that we have expansion now, you can be in Medicaid, at least the expansion version of it, if your income is below 138% of the federal poverty level. And the federal poverty level varies by family size. But I did look at it within the last couple of days. And for a family of four to be within 138% of the federal poverty level, you're talking about an annual income of ballpark $33,000. So you can still be pretty low income, and you can still be relatively poor. A lot of people call the CMH non-Medicaid population the working poor. $33,000 for a family of four isn't a lot of money. And yet, if you're above that level, you can't be in Medicaid.
You mentioned in a recent column in Dome Magazine that your colleagues in the CMH community had asked for a requirement in the legislature's 2015 budget bill that would have helped. It ultimately was not included in the bill. What were you requesting?
Yeah, actually, it wasn't Community Mental Health that was requesting it. It was my organization. All we wanted was a commitment in the bill that come this September, when we'd have about 5 months of actual experience under our belt with Medicaid expansion, that the issue would be revisited and reanalyzed. And I'm not saying it won't be or it can't be. There's nothing to prevent that from happening, but we felt it might calm everyone and might dial everything down a little bit if the legislature stated that come September of 2014, there'll be a reanalysis of where things stand.
We shall see.
Yeah, they ultimately elected not to put it in.
It's not known. Who was at this meeting on Monday?
Well, we had the representatives of the Department of Community Health. We had representatives of the Community Mental Health Boards Association, which is the trade organization for the state's 46 CMH programs.
Any Snyder administration people there?
Outside of the fact that the Department of Community Health is part of the executive branch, no. We did invite some other executive branch officials.
Any lawmakers there?
We invited 10 budget-related lawmakers. Given that this is summer break, that a lot of them are out campaigning too, regrettably, they did not come. But we did have some key legislative policy analysts and some key legislative fiscal analysts who were there. The department and the Community Mental Health Boards Association both made formal presentations. We had a brief reactor panel, and then we had what might have been about an hour and 15 minutes of questions and answers. We had quite a few human service organizations, nonprofit human service organizations represented.
Let's get into the Snyder administration response a little bit more deeply. We've talked with James Haveman, the director of the Michigan Department of Community Health, about this a few times. Back in May, we asked him about the potential cuts to crucial programs for the non-Medicaid population. Here's what he said.
There's some general fund dollars out there yet. You know, they're not all gone, and folks are going to have to learn. We're moving to an arena that is more focused on person care and less on administration. I mean, we have to cut out some administrative costs, and we have to look at programs that are working and what's not working. And there were many things in some of the community mental health boards over the state that I think it's good that they're just stepping back and saying, okay, is this a program that we want to continue, or is this somebody else's responsibility?
Any particular response to what Director Haveman said there?
Well, I agree with some of the things Jim said. We're certainly in a new environment. Yes, there is still and will still be some general fund, non-Medicaid money available. One of the key questions is, will it be enough? On one of the last points about the CMHs have to take a harder look at what programs they could and should offer and for whom, and whether there's other people out there, other providers.
That would seem to be the question. If certain programs or services are not CMH's responsibilities, as he's suggesting, then whose responsibility are they?
That's a critical question here. And Michigan law is very broad on who's eligible for community mental health service consideration, and what should be part of the service package for community mental health service recipients. And I don't think it's a question of the CMHs should be taking a look at who they serve, under what circumstances and with what services. That is a question ultimately for Michigan state government. If they want things to be different than they are now. Right now, community mental health is the public safety net for persons with mental illness and developmental disability needs, regardless of reimbursement sources that are available, regardless of ability to pay. And the CMH system was set up to be there, if necessary, for people who have absolutely no way of paying. So if the executive branch and or the legislature wants to change that, they should try, as opposed to saying, well, CMH, you take a hard look at who you're serving, under what circumstances, with what services, the law already establishes that. And part of the problem here is who else would provide mental health, mental illness, and developmental disability services to vulnerable people in need at no cost?
We have to leave it there. I'm sorry. We'll continue to keep an eye on this situation. Good segment. Mark Reinstein is the president and CEO of the Mental Health Association in Michigan. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Rafiq McGivern is a counselor at Lansing Community College. The Michigan State University graduate has just published his first novel. At Current State, Scott Pohl recently spoke with McGivern about Student Body. Good morning, Scott.
Isn't that a great title for a
murder
mystery,
yeah,
that takes place on a college campus? Actually, Student Body is more than a murder mystery that takes place on the MSU campus, as you'll hear in my talk with Rafiq McGivern. It's one of those writing projects you hear about that was in the works for a number of years.
I began this novel right around the turn of the century, and I had been out of grad school at MSU for close to a decade, and I wrote perhaps the first couple of chapters. And then, yes, it did indeed lie in a drawer. Yes, it was hard copy printed out on, you know, ground wood pulp. 2 years ago, I pulled it out. I said, man, I am going to finish this. And I wrote religiously. I wrote like a writer. I wrote every day. I wrote every morning. I wrote every night, literally, for 2 years, with the exception of about, you know, three or four stray days and a couple of months I had to take off when I was doing a big book editing project for Salem Press. I wrote at least 1,000 words every day. I covered so much emotional ground, so much intellectual ground, so much humorous ground. I covered funny little stories that I remembered, quips that I had said, that people had said, that I really wanted to enshrine. And I tried to capture the camaraderie, the newness of what it means to be in grad school, at least in English, when you're 22, 23 years old, and suddenly now you are on the other side of the desk, and you are teaching classes that have people just like yourselves, perhaps even older, and they're skeptical, and they are almost peers, and you are first among equals only. And it's quite a different experience. It's something you look forward to, and it's something that scares you, but you never talk about being scared.
I have to tell you, when I saw the review of the book written by Ray Walsh in the Lansing State Journal, the first thought that occurred to me was, why hasn't someone in the past already written a murder mystery that takes place on a college campus and called it Student Body?
I don't know. What is wrong with people? It's so obvious. And, you know, really, as a reviewer on Amazon.com noted, the Student Body is a double entendre or a triple, probably at least triple. The novel is kind of a murder mystery. Really, that doesn't come in until just about the end. I could have written another 100 or 200 pages, but I just didn't want to focus on that. I did not want to write an entire mystery. I didn't want to focus on police drama. I wanted the inside. I wanted a guy who had made a mistake, not an academic one, but a deep personal mistake. And if that mistake comes out, he's done. He's done academically. He's out of his job. He's out of his program. He'll never get that doctorate. He'll never become a professor. And he's out of his marriage. Perhaps he's even out of his life. The character does remember that, you know, sometimes those things happen to people who lose everything. And he comes close to losing everything. So it's an emotional, nostalgic novel. It's intellectual, it's playful, it's elusive with an A. It's readable. I hope it's a lot of fun.
Well, let's synopsize the story.
Rick O'Donnell is a personable young doctoral student in English, circa fall 1993. He's married with a wife and three young children. The year before, however, he was teaching a class with a very smart, witty, lovely young student with whom he had a perfectly normal instructor-student type of relationship. He was having a difficult time in his marriage, and the semester after, she graduated, and she was in a graduate class that he himself was taking. They ended up having an affair, brief, passionate, the kind of thing where you kid yourself and you say, well, it's not really important. It's fun, but it doesn't really mean anything. And there are certain words they never said, never. And they never planned about the future, not more than a day or a week ahead. Where would they have lunch the next day? What would Dr. Rosenblatt teach about tomorrow? There were certain words they never said. Rick put it behind him. Now, the next year, the next fall, his supervisor happens to look at changes of grades, notice that he did one for this girl, changed her grade in his class from a 2-point to a 4-point. Instructor error, clerical error. I've done this probably once or twice in a career of 20 years, accidentally bubbled in the wrong number. And that was correct, but let's face it, young instructor, beautiful young student, they took a class together the next semester. That was when he changed her grade. This guy's in trouble. He either has his affair found out, or he's under this cloud of suspicion that he'll never be able to get out from under. So the novel follows a really tense week and a half. Much of it is retrospective. He's struggling with the issue at hand, but he's remembering every second of those months, and he's remembering how he fell in love with his wife, and how he might have fallen out of love with her, and how he tried to get back. And then it all comes to a head, and it ends.
Moral Hall, Spartan Village. Your book is rife with MSU references, takes place on the MSU campus. Mm-hmm. That's part of the appeal for a local audience, even if you don't work at MSU or attend MSU.
Perhaps so.
People like to read books that take place in locales they recognize.
Mm-hmm. I have such an extraordinary fondness for old Moral Hall and for Spartan Village. I lived there. I started my family there. You know, I remember being 22 years old, hiking across campus with the twins in a stroller, bringing them into my office, meeting the secretaries. And I look back so fondly on that, and I can still see that place, and I can smell it, and I can hear the way the floorboards creaked. And that's part of what I really wanted to capture.
I want to ask you a little bit about self-publishing, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because this isn't one of those major publication house releases that's making the New York Times bestseller list. Sad to say. But the act of self-publishing, first of all, it's getting so much easier these days. Was that your intent from the start, or did you shop this around to publishing houses? How did that play out in your case?
I did shop it around. I spent quite a fair bit of months shopping it around to perhaps 20 or 30 places. Anybody who writes, anybody even who doesn't write, understands how difficult it is to break into publishing. As you say, self-publishing is really easy nowadays. And obviously, it does have a connotation that, well, obviously you had to self-publish it because no one would take it. I got some really good feedback from publishers. Actually, the thing was scheduled to be published by a place in Michigan called My Green Publisher, which, despite the "my" in the title, really was not a self-publishing joint. It was a very small joint, however, and they ended up going out of business like 3 months before my book was to be released, which was a hell of a kick in the teeth. I got people saying this was really nice writing, and this was a romance house, but I can't have a guy who cheats on his wife. You know, this is really good writing, but gee, the guy's only going to lose his job and his career and his marriage. I'm not sure that's really important. I have a friend across the pond in the UK who wrote a thriller. It's sort of a James Bond plus romance. Great fellow. He spent a couple of years of just difficult, you know, going from one publisher to another, being accepted by a publisher, and then they just sort of fade out and they don't answer his emails. And he told me, buddy, you know, you could send to 500 publishers. It's going to take that long, Rafik. It's going to take that long. And after a while, I said, screw it. Like Frankie, I will do it my way. Now, what I've produced, I think, is pretty literate, pretty enjoyable. It's unusual. It's a genre straddler. It's not a romance, but it's romantic, deeply romantic. It's not a memoir, but obviously I have drawn from real life. It's not a murder mystery, and yet it is. It's if there is a genre called fiction of academia, which there may or may not be, this is that. It straddles a lot of things, and I just finally said, you know, I'm not going to spend year after year after year looking, hoping to try to find the right niche. I'm just going to do it myself. And if a few people end up loving this book like I do, I'm happy.
And people can find it in your typical online book retail operations.
Exactly.
And maybe a few of the local bookstores, too.
Exactly. It is produced by Amazon CreateSpace in paperback and Amazon Kindle in e-whatever. And it's definitely available on Amazon websites, on Barnes & Noble, really on a number of other ones. I did a web search, and it's actually able to be purchased all around the world, Hong Kong, India, Europe, so it's kind of neat to see it out there.
All right, well, what's next, Rafiq McGivern, author of Student Body? What's next under your pen?
Well, I have had another one of these desk drawer projects, a YA novel of science fiction that I think I'm about to return to. I'm about 100 pages in, and I think I may do that next.
Will you let me know when it's ready?
I will.
Rafiq McGivern is the author of the new novel, Student Body. Thank you so much for joining us on Current State.
Thanks so much, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And rejoining us on the show today is our book reviewer, Scott Southard. This time, Scott reviews a novel by an author who's brave enough to rewrite Shakespeare.
The fool doth think he is wise, but the wise man knows himself to be a fool. While some would take this quote from Shakespeare as merely insightful into human nature, author Christopher Moore takes it as gospel. Moore's character, named Pocket, is the very same fool from the great bard's King Lear, and this fool is the wisest person in any throne room. Pocket first appeared in Christopher Moore's wonderful satire, Fool, reinventing the classic Shakespeare tragedy from the perspective of this intrepid character. In that novel, Pocket is the mastermind for the undoing of King Lear and his two wicked daughters. Now, Pocket has returned in a new book, The Serpent of Venice. In this comedy adventure, Pocket is stuck in Venice, and it begins with him trapped in a cellar, preparing to experience a slow and horrible death. From there, the story grows to include mermaids, a best friend named Othello, a merchant named Shylock, and a villain named Iago, who really doesn't have a chance against a brain like Pocket's. You don't have to be a Shakespeare scholar to enjoy Moore's books. Christopher Moore is in a way like a great English 101 professor, the kind who enjoys the literary section of the library and wants you to as well. If anything, a reader will want to open the pages of The Merchant of Venice, Othello, and King Lear afterwards to see what Moore accomplishes in these comedy books. Christopher Moore, for me, resides in the same wonderful literary corner as Douglas Adams and P.G. Wodehouse. These are comedy writers who are highly creative, who don't talk down to their readers, and wit reigns supreme. One of the things I really enjoy about these books is the philosophy hiding behind them, for Moore finds humor and hope in tragedy. Most of us know that these stories in Shakespeare's hands end badly, so you want to see how Moore is going to, well, I'm not going to say fix, but correct them. It's rare that I would enjoy someone changing sacred texts like Shakespeare, but in Moore's hands, I want to see how his creativity will get Pocket out of another horrible mess. My only wish for Christopher Moore is that he continues these adventures of Pocket. I want to see Pocket dealing with fairies in A Midsummer Night's Dream, drinking with Falstaff, and debating philosophy with Hamlet. There is nothing but possibility ahead for a fun and witty character like Pocket. Or, as Shakespeare put it, some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. Moore's Fool is a little of all three. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Thank you. And current state contributor Scott Southard is author of the novels A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth and The Case of the Dangerous Dare. More of his writings can be found at his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. Lansing's Crego Park has been closed more than 25 years. It reopens today at noon. Lansing's largest park by acreage, Crego Park. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll listen to Great Lakes Folk Festival participants Heartland Klezmerim as part of our Live Music Friday series. Also, we'll talk with a Williamston woman leaving for Nepal to work with victims of sexual abuse. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Glad you could join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.